911, what's your emergency?
I'm blue!
Ma'am, mental health crises are very common around the holidays. I'll connect you to some mental health services.
Thank you. Nailed it.
I love it. I love it. Very literal for this holiday, this Christmas in July. Welcome.
Happy Christmas
back
in
to
July,
the First
everybody.
Podcast, everybody. We are getting Hallmark with it this year. We are getting so festive. I have my little Santa hat on and nothing else.
And that's just the way we do it on this edgy podcast. You could even say that our podcast is a little blue. At times.
It's a little blue. It's a little blue dabba-dee-dabba-die, okay?
So true. True blue. And you know what? Today we are covering Season 3, Episode 10, Christmas Spirit, directed by Alonzo Alvarez and written by Andrew Myers, who I think was one of our allies, if I remember correctly.
I believe so. That sounds correct. That sounds like it's hitting the right notes in my brain. This episode I found to be more memorable and iconic than last year's Christmas episode.
I thought so too.
I quite enjoyed this one. I thought it was emotionally resonant when it needed to be, and I thought the calls were also by and large very funny.
Yeah, I think they picked a lot of good ones for this episode, like a lot of kind of classic holiday scenarios.
I loved like the media inspirations that that they drew upon, because as this episode, you know, opens, we get a come all ye faithful needle drop in a scenario that is highly reminiscent of the hit 90s Arnold Schwarzenegger Christmas family classic, Jingle All the Way.
Jingle All the Way. I was wondering about that because I've never seen that movie, but I think I am familiar with that opening where, yeah, it's a similar thing of him like trying to get the toy that everybody wants, right?
Yeah. And I'm actually genuinely curious how common this kind of scenario is nowadays. It feels very 90s, in its setup. Like, I don't know how many kids are still like, you know, chomping at the bits for the newest doll or the newest action figure.
Well, listen, now that we've got those laboo-boos,
oh,
who knows?
No, you're so right. You're so right.
That's kind of like the new Beanie Babies, right? Like, we finally have another toy craze, even among adults, and it's laboo-boos. I don't know if kids are into that, but adults, you know, I'm sure this Christmas, all the parents are going to be clamoring at the laboo-boo store. Where do you even buy those? I actually don't know. Because I think they're hideous, so I've never bought one.
No, I agree. I've never bought one, and I've never been tempted to buy one. They do sell them in Times Square for all of our local New Yorker listeners.
I'm sure. I bet they have a bunch of knockoffs in Times Square, too.
Our friend Brooklyn, who we saw on the pod back in Season 2, has been tweeting a little bit about laboo-boos, and he tweeted something that I thought was very, very resonant about the laboo-boo craze, which was a quote tweet of a dub of a laboo-boo tweet with the caption "new vocal stem unlocked." It was a big hit tweet.
Right.
So, you know, good for Brooklyn.
The like 90-year-old Hungarian grandma who goes laboo-boo.
Laboo-boo. No, that's great. That's great. But this one is possibly even better. This one, it's Jabba the Hutt going,
ooh, hoo, hoo, matcha pilates in Bali before a laboo-boo rave. Ooh, hoo, hoo.
I think I saw that too. Wow, we are way too online. But also,
it sometimes feels
like you're just living in a totally parallel universe to everybody else, because I don't, until like a week ago, I didn't know what a laboo-boo was. I didn't know what Dubai matcha chocolate was.
I've never had the Dubai chocolate, and I don't know where to get it. And quite frankly, I'm not interested in finding out. With that, let's just dive into the episode as we so often do. So
right.
As I said, come all ye faithful needle drop. And this woman is trying to navigate the madness of what appears to be a department store parking lot.
Yeah, somebody like cuts her off for the parking place she's been waiting for. She's like the one kind person in a sea of crazed, evil holiday shoppers.
We're going to see a very dark night sort of turn with her
as
the scene goes on.
It's really kind of brilliant how much of a character arc they give this woman in such a short amount of time. because we see her get cut off in the parking lot. We see she's entering the store and everybody's just pushing past her. No regard for etiquette or manners. She tries talking to one of the people in the store asking, like, do you know where I can get this like duck toy that my kids are asking for? And, you know, the person just like without even looking up is like, yeah, it's in like aisle 7. And, you know, before she can even ask where that is, they walk away.
I will say these poor retail workers. Can we all just send up like a silent prayer for like these retail workers? Because like, you know, it's the worst time of the year. It's like on par with like movie theaters when like a big tentpole blockbuster comes out. You know,
when the Minecraft movie comes out.
Yeah.
But she finally gets to the toy display, and apparently it's one of those viral toys, like in like a Labubu, you could say.
Like and, a Labubu. Okay. A Labubu.
A Labubu. And all the shoppers are rushing to get this toy, but our girl manages to grab the last one. Yay, she's prevailed. But suddenly some asshole guy rips it out of her hands. There's like an ADR line dubbed in that I thought was really funny, where he says, "My kid's better than your kid." Like, I think it was dubbed in, so it's like, apparently they didn't think it was evil enough for him to just grab the toy out of her hand. He had to also be like, "I'm doing this because I personally hate you and your kid and think that me and my kid are better."
Kind of a nod to Yasmina Reza in like God of Carnage, like with the way that like this sort of like a this sort of playground ish like toy craze like causes the parents to devolve into children themselves. I was quite enjoying this scenario because what does she do as a tax-paying adult woman who's just been humiliated and you know, publicly denounced by this man? What is she gonna do? She takes out her mace and fucking maces him in the face.
She has had enough. That's when she snapped. She's had enough. She's had it. She's fed up with this cruel, uncaring world. And yes, much like the Joker, she becomes radicalized.
All it takes. All it takes is one bad day. Okay.
Right.
And this is queen shit. Honestly, I love that. I love that she maces this guy. I love that people start freaking out and she starts macing them too. She starts macing everyone. She's like, it's like she's Frank and she like whips out her gun and she's like, I just start blasting. Like,
I was totally on her side. I was 100% on her side. Finally, who should come up to her but Mall Santa? And like in Mall character, Santa. He starts essentially like negotiating this hostage situation. And like, you know, he's like, just give me the mace. You know, I'm Santa. You can trust me. And he's almost got her. But right as she's about to hand it to him, she just maces him too.
She maces Santa Claus in front of everyone. Let's hold space for this. Okay. She maces Santa Claus. It's the best show on television.
What a way to begin our I was about to say, what a way to begin our Halloween episode. No. What a way to begin our Christmas episode. That is getting a little scary.
It was very much a Nightmare Before Christmas. That is true.
Yeah.
But, you know, so she gets arrested, predictably, because this is, like, assault en masse that she's doing. And, like, I get it, you're pushed to the brink, diva, but, like, this is the one time Athena makes a good arrest, because this woman is clearly going through something. And so
she's a woman on the verge of a Christmas breakdown, which is my first pitch for title of this episode.
Woman on the verge of a Christmas breakdown. We'll consider that pitch and we'll circle back later.
Right.
Athena cuffs her and you know, they're, you know, taking her away. The one cop has that little dancing duck toy. It's like a diva duck. Right. And she's like, oh, thank you so much for hanging on to that for me. And Athena's like, bitch, you fucking thought. No, that is going into evidence. And you're going behind the bars. That and, you know, presumably a trial will commence. But Santa is on a stretcher. A very surreal sight. Santa on a stretcher surrounded by, you know, the 118.
And children who are all worried for Santa, right? So they're all like, is Santa gonna die? Whatever. And Buck, a big dummy that he is, tries to console these kids by saying, oh, don't worry. He's not really Santa. kids instantly start crying. They're like, Santa's pretend. And Buck, with this huge smile on his face, just goes, that's right.
He's more clueless than Hannah Montana in that episode where she visits the class of second graders. Do you remember that episode?
No, but listen, listen. I have to say, you know, all the parents come over and they get mad at Buck for this. But to be fair, he didn't literally tell them that Santa isn't real, period. He was just trying to tell them that this particular mall Santa was not the real Santa, which, controversial opinion, hot take, I think kids should know that even if they believe Santa's real, they should know that the mall Santa is like a guy dressed up as Santa. That's what I think. I think these kids look pretty old. They looked like 12 years old. I feel like you should know that the mall Santa isn't real Santa. I feel like you should just tell your kids like, oh, that's like a representative of Santa. That's one of his employees. Because Santa can't be in all these cities at once, obviously. He's at work.
But then they're going to ask more questions like, how is he going to every house in the world in a night? Like, they're going to this just leads to more questions.
That is his job. But leading up to Christmas, that's his busiest time of the year. He is working. He is constantly on the clock, working, you know, 90 hours a week. How could we possibly expect him to be at all these malls?
Why are you trying to steal Christmas?
I'm not. Okay. The only people trying to steal Christmas are the people telling Buck that he's wrong for telling these
eight-year-old children should not know about labor unions. Eight-year-old children should not know about labor unions. They should not know about workplace abuse. You've got to get them started young
or else they will not know their rights and not know how to advocate for themselves.
Christmas is a time for magic. No, this is a house of cards the Santa mythos is built on.
Unions and the rights of the worker.
Even a little bit of it, then the entire thing's going to topple over. First, you know, that's not real Santa. Then what's next? Santa isn't real. Then what's next after that? Boom, heroin. Boom, no future.
Okay, slippery slope fallacy.
Boom. Okay. No college, no career, you know, gonna end up, you know, in a ditch somewhere, you know, begging.
My opponent is using a clear slippery slope fallacy argument, and therefore I'm gonna disregard all of his opinions, which is probably in itself a logical fallacy.
Overruled. Overruled. Jane, stop being a Grinch. I don't care if your reasons are sound, okay?
Overruled. Like, my opponent just admitted that my reasons are sound. No.
Your reasons are sound from an adult perspective, from a child. Put yourself in the mind of a child, in the eyes of a child.
No, I refuse to.
You have to, okay? Because you're one day out of the whole stinking year, you get to go and see Santa Claus. You're one sliver of hope in this fucked up world. And you know what? Some dirtbag, you know, twink cop is out here telling you, firefighter.
Yeah, there's a big fucking difference. And you know what? The real sliver of hope in the world is for both children and adults.
Unions
and the rights of the worker. Because the reason we
are smart. Okay?
If not for these kids workers' rights, those children would still be working in the mines and the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And so for that reason, I think these kids have a right to know about the labor rights that they have as children, and that Santa has.
Counterpoint.
And you can maintain the illusion that Santa is real while also acknowledging that Santa need not work himself to death, nor should
Counterpoint.
He.
Counterpoint. The defense's argument all rests on the fallacy that children should have labor unions. The fact is, studies have shown
time and time again,
the children yearn for the mines. These are
the
facts.
The studies do not show that.
These are facts, okay? And on, quite frankly, I don't subscribe to your brand of, you know, cyber fascism that you believe that Santa Claus should be, you know, like an antiquated idea for these kids, that they should just grow up and grow out of it and start organizing. He's seven. Jane, he's seven.
Counterpoint, this bit has more than run its course, so let's move on. We cut
to
Michael.
The prosecution rests.
Sound off in the comments. Who won? We cut
Michael
to
got
Michael
a tree.
At home.
Michael got a tree. Okay.
He is setting up the Christmas tree at Athena's house and the decorations. May and Harry come in. They're like, are you sure we should be doing this without Mom? She loves to set up the Christmas decorations. But Michael's like, your mom's kind of in a bad mood right now because we still think that Bobby might have cancer. And, you know, the kids are still worried about that. You'll recall from his, like, radiation exposure in the previous episode. And Michael wants to make Bobby's first real Christmas with the family special, you know, to distract him from the terrifying idea that he might have radiation-caused cancer.
Question for you, Jane. How awesome would this episode have been if Michael put up the tree and it was revealed that within that tree was Alvin and the Chipmunks?
That would have been way cooler, and I would have liked that as a storyline for Michael way more than what we end up getting in this episode, but we'll get there.
Yeah. They're decorating, they're doing that whole, like, you know, breaking out the Christmas presents thing, that are the decorations. Michael opens the box of, like, the tree ornaments, and he sees this picture of the Grant family pre-Bobby, pre-divorce, pre-gay, even, as going to see, you know, a man that's totally not Santa Claus because Harry and May need to learn about labor unions. And he gets
the correct position.
The thing that you start to pick up on, like, right away, you're just like, oh, man, is Michael going to be jealous again?
Yeah. And you're like, really? Like, it's been three seasons. Let's move on. But we see Michael getting a little emotional, and suddenly Bobby and Athena get home. They tell everybody that Bobby's bill of health is still looking clear. You know, they haven't gotten his test results back yet, but things are looking good. Michael, like, says hi, but then makes a very hasty exit. It's clear that he got emotional and now kind of doesn't feel comfortable sticking around. So he just races out of there.
Which is interesting, like, an interesting reaction to the news that Bobby's probably fine. You know, they did the blood work. They're monitoring him.
Yeah, he's like, man, I was hoping he would die.
Yeah, but instead it turns out that, oh, no, he just, when you gotta go, you gotta go. And, you know, with him goes the scene. They're like, oh, that was weird. And we go to a heady moment.
Heady moment. Eddie and Hen are at Eddie's house talking about parenting, because we hear that Christopher was very upset to hear that Eddie will have to work on Christmas this year. I have to say, this episode is funny, and I think I might have brought this up with our last Christmas episode too, that I just find it really funny in episodes like this that they kind of turn into Hallmark movies, in the sense that all of a sudden, in a show that is not usually about Christmas at all, all of a sudden, every emotional conflict has to be Christmas related. It's like, Christopher is upset because Christmas was very important to our family. You know, Michael's having feelings about the blended family because it's Christmas.
In fairness, Christmas is not that important. That's for true. 11 months out of the year as well. So I can suspend my disbelief, like, in, like, a real world sense. I do love, though, that in this episode, the Chris-Eddie conflict is essentially, like, Chris is used basically as a prop, not to convey his own discontent, but more so the idea of discontent around the Christmas season. Not even, like, specifically, like, Dad, you work too much. It's just, like, the very, like, sort of vague idea of, like, people are unhappy this Christmas season.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting, because later in this scene, we continue to see this sentiment of, like, they won't really tell you what is actually off, but just everybody is feeling like this Christmas isn't as happy. I guess, to be fair, Bobby did just get exposed to a ton of radiation, and Hen did just kill a girl with a truck. But
I mean, they've had a big year, right?
True.
Buck got stuck. Maddie killed her abusive husband. Like, there was a whole thing with Tara. There was, like, a lot of drama.
True.
The tsunami. Okay, this was
okay.
This is
I take it back. They have their reasons.
So but like, also, like, I mean, we've all, like, had that feeling, right? Like, you know, like, I feel like the last five Christmases of mine, and this maybe just says something about me, but, like, I'm like, it always rolls around. I'm like, man. I'm not feeling the holiday
spirit. Well, it's almost like you're not a child
that's
anymore.
So weird.
You know, I think that's the real thing, is you get to be an adult.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh,
I'm like a self-sufficient adult with bills.
Yeah, like, I have to pay money for people's presents. I have to figure out travel. You know, I have to be around my family regardless of how I feel about everybody.
But there is one person who is feeling the Christmas spirit more than anyone, and it is, of course, the 118's resident pet dog, Buck Buckley, who is making gingerbread houses with Chris and Denny.
Well, we get a great moment, a classic moment, where Eddie says, I thought it'd be nice to bring the boys together for a play date, and says, yeah, all three of them. And then we cut to Christopher, Denny, and Buck, all making gingerbread houses together. Eddie looks at them fondly, which could mean nothing, you know? And Chris heartbreakingly asks Buck if he can spend Christmas with him this year, because, you know, that's his other dad. And Buck, of course, is like, no, like, I'm also working. I work the exact same shifts as your father because we're married.
But it is so sad, you know what I mean? Like, hearing Chris say that, like,
yeah.
Oh, man, that's really tough.
But then Buck comes over to Hen and Eddie and expresses the thing we were just talking about, where he says, is it just me or does Christmas suck this year? And again, it's like, you can infer from everything that's happened in the last year why that would be true. But like, up to now in this episode, we haven't seen anything implying that. So it's kind of just like, wait, what? Why does it suck this year? But they all feel that way because Bobby might have cancer. Everybody has to work on Christmas. Hen just killed somebody.
Maybe Santa on the stretcher was like the omen, you know what I mean? Maybe they're just sensing the omen of that, like, this is like the death of Christmas. But, you know, it sort of ends on that, like, that death knell note of like, oh, holiday cheer is over, and we go to someone having an even rockier Christmas season, which is Maddie Buckley, who is collecting marital assets, which have been, you know,
she's like meeting with her lawyer,
set aside for her,
and receiving a check for almost $500,000, essentially from Doug, because this is her share of the marital assets. There's kind of an interesting exchange where Maddie is like, I thought that, like, legally I wasn't even entitled to any of this stuff. And the lawyer is like, oh, no, the Slayer statute only applies to murder, which this is a thing, that there's like a statute that if you kill your wife or husband or whatever, you do not get their money, obviously, or else people would just be killing their spouses all the time. Black Widow style, the classic archetype, not the superhero. And
so if you want to kill your spouse, you have to be crafty with it. You know, you have to, like, really, like, paint a scenario and really sell it. Right.
Right. But anyway, they talk about Maddie. Obviously, this case was self-defense, so that statute doesn't apply. She's entitled to her half of the money.
Yeah, but she's struggling with it, you know.
She is struggling with it because it's obviously, it feels to her like dirty money. It feels like this is Doug's money. And by taking it, it's sort of tethering her to him all the more. But her lawyer really encourages her to take it. She's like, you are entitled to this. This is your right to have this. I think you should take it and not worry about that. We leave her on that conflicted note.
I will say, like, I do think Maddie should take her reparations and, like, you know, do whatever she wants with it. Like, if I were her, I'd get a jacuzzi. You know what I mean? I would go on, like, a, you know, 2-week vacation to, you know, like the coast of Italy or something like that. But Maddie,
I would get like 5 more college degrees.
Oh, exactly. Right. Okay. In this economy, 1 more college degree. Let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. 500,000. Let's be real. That's not going to cover more than one.
Even if she doesn't want to keep it, she can donate it and feel good about herself for, like, putting it to good use. I don't know. But yeah, we leave it on that note of, like, well, you know, what am I going to do with this? I don't have closure, etc. And so we cut to, I wrote in my notes, faggots going to Hawaii, and then in parentheses, straight.
And yes, so well, we know he's straight because he's at the airport with his wife. Unless that was just like, he was her GBF.
Why did you assume I was talking about him? I was talking about him? What can a woman not be a faggot? Are we not in 2025?
I mean, I guess. I think I missed you saying that word when you said that sentence. I think I just thought you said man going to Hawaii. Oh. So that was my point of confusion.
No, wait, no, this is great. This is great for, like, a psychoanalysis of Jane. She like, the words faggot and man are interchangeable in her brain.
Synonyms.
All men are faggots to Jane.
And, you know, that's just my radical feminism, radical gay. Love
to see it.
We've we've got this man, if you know what I mean, at the airport with his quote-unquote wife.
And their quote-unquote kids, right?
And his quote-unquote bag of golf clubs. And he
I don't want to know what he's doing with them.
He and his wife and family are going on a little vacation to Hawaii, and they get to the bag check, and you know they're like, oh, we're only checking these two suitcases, but the agent there says, actually, you have to check those golf clubs, like you can't take those on the plane. And the husband is very distraught by this. He, you know, these are like his brand new gift of golf clubs. He doesn't want to let them out of his sight. But, you know, the lady insists, so he sadly... I thought this actor was doing really funny, like, over-the-top facial expressions.
And it was so perfectly matched with, like, the perfect deadpan, like, TSA help lady.
Yeah.
Like bag checker, because she is so over this guy. She's so, like, she has, this is, like, her, like, 500th guy of the day, and she just wants to go home and be with her family, you know? And so he parts with the clubs, and I can sympathize with this man. I don't play golf because I'm not a racist, but you know, I understand, like, you know, if you get an expensive piece of equipment that's brand new, you don't want to part with it. Like if you got, like, you know, a new guitar or a, I don't know, something like a,
Yeah. My sister never checks her viola, because that would just be, that's like a huge, huge investment of money. And it would just be dumb to check it and not have it in your sight the whole time. She always goes up to, like, the gate agent when she's on flights, and she'll say, she's like, would I please be able to board first so that I can stow my violin? She always says that because she knows nobody's heard of a viol outside of music fields.
She's so iconic for that. But people respect the violin.
They do. They do. So she's usually able to, like, get a good spot for it that way. But anyway, he leaves his precious clubs. And we then see on the tarmac, we've got two employees who are loading bags onto, like, a cart to bring it over to whatever the stow, the cargo hold of the planes. And we've got, like, one employee who hates his job and his life and is, like, just throwing the bags around, like, I don't give a fuck. Which, honestly, I respect. That job probably sucks. Yeah. But then the
Very
other
Toy
employee...
Story too, I will say.
Yeah. The other employee really cares. And he's like, don't you care about the Christmas spirit? People's lives are in these bags. We've got to be careful with them. And so he's we've got two... A funny little odd couple here working at the airport.
It's good to know that there is a buck in every profession. This is, you know, this is because he is the buck of the TSA in this scene. Okay. He really
extremely
is.
Corny, emotional man who really cares about his job.
He's wearing a Santa hat. You know what
he
I
is.
Mean? Like,
do you think this guy was living his entire own drama off screen where, like, he got crushed by a plane and his leg was injured and he had to go on blood thinners, so he wasn't sure if they would let him back into TSA.
Well, this call is probably his fire truck moment, honestly. Like,
oh,
he's probably gonna have to go
on
blood thinners
right.
because of this. And honestly, I think this guy who he's having this little, like, rapport with is probably his Eddie, to
oh,
be
that's
honest.
That's his Eddie. Oh my God.
That's
you
his
guys.
Eddie.
We should start, like, a subculture of people who ship these two cargo guys from this episode. I don't know if they even had names.
But TSA Eddie is, you know, he's trying to fill up the cart as much as possible. He gets to the clubs. The clubs
it
come
makes sense.
Down.
He's the moody one. He's Mr. Broody.
He's Mr. Broody. Okay. And he gets to the clubs and, like, the whole thing's full. Like, TSA Buck is like, oh, it's full. We got to wait for the next one. He's like, nope, we're doing this. He takes the clubs and he jams them into the passenger seat and it hits the pedal.
It hits
slams
the gas
the pedal.
Pedal.
The gas
Literally
pedal.
Literally
and-
the worst thing that could have happened.
Yeah.
The cart is now speeding across the tarmac. It hits a guy. It starts, like, going around in circles. It's spilling luggage everywhere.
This is all happening to, like, the tune of, like, a Strauss waltz. It's very well done. I really enjoyed the way this scene was, like, shot and edited. And so, of course, what's TSA Buck gonna do but Rambo his way into another cart and fucking derail the thing, right? He just smashes it into, like, the rogue cart. And he gets out all smiley.
We should also note that the dad with the golf clubs is, like, watching all of this from the gate window. going, yeah. Oh my God, my clubs. Because he can see that his golf clubs have caused this entire tragedy. So anyway, yeah. Yes, the guy gets off of the cart, like all proud, when suddenly both the clubs and the employee are sucked into the plane engine.
Like the turbine. Yeah. Like it like sucks them in, and you get like a little comedy beat, like 911, what's your emergency? And then the waltz, like yeah. tune ends, and then it goes to commercial.
Isn't there someone in Final Destination who, like, when the plane is crashing, gets sucked into the engine?
Mm.
Like, we've all seen it play out in some movie or another.
I think so. You definitely see this in, like, a lot of movies. Oh, it was in the first episode of Lost, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
This is it's definitely it's a classic scenario. It's at the end of The Incredibles.
Classic
Syndrome.
Way to get killed by a plane in a movie.
Like, Syndrome and, like, what was her name? Stratigale in The Incredibles. They got sucked into, like, a jet engine because of their capes.
Right.
Right. So this guy, you know, Edna Mode would have been having a field day with this guy. No Santa hats, etc.
But the 118 arrives and Bobby is just like kind of at a loss for what to do. He's like, Buck, Eddie, get me everything.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing here is like the engine has stopped, but now you can just see like some luggage poking out and just the guy's legs poking out. So you assume that he is like dead as fuck, like the legs, and then probably just like a human smoothie from the waist up. But remarkably, the legs start moving and they realize the guy is somehow still alive.
Mm-hmm. Not only alive, but because the luggage clogged up the turbines before he got in there. He is fully intact, like miraculously fully intact. You know, thank God, you know, Boeing flimsy planes are finally good for something.
Seriously. I was wondering that throughout this scene. I was like, I wonder if this would total the plane, you know, because you hear about apparently one of the things that can make a plane crash is like when a bird flies into the engine, which is kind of scary because you would think that would happen all the time. But I guess it's pretty rare. But that can be enough to like totally make the entire plane fail for some reason. So an entire guy in the engine, let alone a whole thing of golf clubs, like I could see them having to replace this whole plane.
Hopefully it was like an old plane and like it was going to be decommissioned anyways, you know, so like this is like it's final voyage.
It's like the Titanic.
Isn't it it's the opposite of the Titanic? What?
Oh, I forgot that the Titanic sank on its maiden voyage, not its last voyage.
That was its maiden voyage, Jane.
I'm done. I might have been thinking
It was the captain's last voyage. It was the captain's last voyage on the Titanic.
Wasn't it the Edmund Fitzgerald that was like on its last trip when it sank?
I don't know. We can just say
that might have been it.
It's like the Odyssey. You know, it's
sure.
It's going down.
It's like a lot
of
things, you know.
Yeah,
but they unscrew the engine parts and they slowly get the guy out. Buck, finally, when they've got the guy on the stretcher and like it's looking like he's going to be okay, Buck retrieves the mangled golf clubs and he's like, it looks like these got sucked into the engine and stopped the blades, like saving this guy. But the dad is still watching from the gate and he just faints because he's so sad to see his mangled golf clubs. But it's like, bro, they saved a life. And also probably your insurance and or this airline is going to cover it, you know, because like this was in no way your fault.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully he'll at least like get some sort of compensation for the luggage loss. Like I feel like they all will, because this is like presumably a big airline, like they're flying like Delta or something, and I think they have policies for that. I don't know if they have policies for this specifically, but
they've got policies for lost luggage for
I'm sure there's a precedent to draw on, right? And if not, set it yourself, King. But, you know, they get it out. They get the guy on the stretcher. All's well. And then, oh, no, Bobby, his nose, it's bleeding.
It's kind of like, guys, for all my Bollywood fans out there, I'm going to make a Bollywood reference. It's kind of like that moment, like halfway through the movie Kal Ho Na Ho, where everybody is like celebrating, having a great time at Naina and Rohit's engagement party.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, they've all been singing that song Mahi Ve, which is one of my favorites. They're all dancing and Shahrukh Khan is dancing like crazy. And then suddenly he starts to feel something in his chest and he starts to collapse. Boom, plot twist. Then the rest of the movie happens and like total tone shift and everything is different now. That's the first Bollywood movie I ever watched. And it was awesome. It got me hooked. I was sobbing in my 10th grade film studies class. Sobbing. Real tears.
You know what? I was actually going to make the same comparison. So I'm glad you put that out there.
Yeah, you know, you would love Calhoun Ajo. It's set in New York, although they filmed it in Toronto.
Very fun. Wait, I think I may have seen clips from that.
It's a famous one.
But I feel like Bollywood really likes to set movies in New York. You know, if they're going to do like an American story, they love to set it in New York.
I mean, there's a big Indian diaspora there.
Oh, yeah, 100%. So Bobby, you know, he has a little nosebleed. And so what's Buck going to do but interrogate the shit out of him? And let me just say, in the interest of fairness, should Bobby not be put on leave for 5 months?
Ooh, wouldn't that be funny if, like, it turned out Buck wasn't worried because he, like, thinks Bobby could be sick. He just really wants to get back at him for, like, not letting him back to work. And he's like, oh, starts, like, really rubbing it in his face. Like, that would be just evil Buck moment.
Unfortunately, he seems to lack, the mental capacity to carry a grudge against anyone that's not his parents.
I think he lacks the evilness, you know? He has, like, the innocent mind of a child or perhaps a large dog.
Yeah, and so because of that, instead he just starts spouting off like Marie Curie top 10 fun facts.
Yeah, in his Buck way, he has done a ton of research about Bobby's ailment. Presumably he did the same thing Athena did at the end of the last episode where he just went on search or whatever and
search.
Googled radiation poisoning.
No, he didn't Google it. He searched it. Let's be clear here. Buck says something funny because Bobby's like, yeah, I didn't even know who you knew who Madame Marie Curie was. And he goes, well, I do. She was a really smart lady and she still died.
But specifically, he implies that he like learned about Marie Curie for the first time, like doing this research, which it's one thing not to know much about her. Like, I don't know that much about her, but to like not even know the name. I like the implication that he had never even heard of her before doing research about radiation poisoning.
We need to get like Miss Pillsbury to give like that pamphlet she showed and like in like the background of one episode of Glee that says Radon, the silent killer.
But Buck finds out in this scene that the station Christmas dinner poll is tied between Chinese and burgers, which upsets childish Buck.
Bobby like very skillfully reorients the conversation away from himself. Yeah. Doing this.
Which upsets Buck because he wants a trad Christmas turkey dinner. Because again, he's like a child and it's kind of like in last season's Christmas episode where he was like, wow, Maddie, how dare you not like Christmas as much as I want you to. In this season, it's like, wow, how dare we not have a real traditional Christmas dinner at my workplace?
I totally get him for this though, because like I get upset if like a year like passes like without like a traditional Christmas or Christmas Eve like celebration, like a proper Christmas dinner. Because I love a Christmas ham, I love a Christmas goose, I love a Christmas turkey, I love it all.
I guess I'm coming from a place where like my family doesn't always do the traditional Christmas dinner. Like sometimes we've done like trying out something new and interesting. Like we tried doing fondue once when I was little. You know, we've
for
done
Christmas?
Paella because that's what for Christmas. Because my mom's big like celebratory meal she makes is paella. Or you know, one year I think we did Indian food. Like we kind of like to do non-traditional Christmas food sometimes.
I see, because Bobby seems to be on your side because he, you know, to break the tie, defects to Chinese. Right?
Mm.
And Buck clocks this. Oh, fatigue. Also a symptom.
Right. Because Bobby says he doesn't want to make, he doesn't feel up to making Christmas dinner. But then Buck gets serious and he admits to Bobby that Bobby is one of the most important people in his life. And he doesn't know what he would do if something were to happen to him, which, like that moment in the last episode, now it rings very different in hindsight. But also, Buckbee moment. Come on.
Buckbee moment. Even if it is like, it does feel like a little ghoulish to watch and get invested in now that like, it's like dramatic irony. You know, it's like, we know, but he doesn't know. And he doesn't know. And Bobby says this thing that his grandma used to say to him. He says, don't go bothering trouble, which I like. I like that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like... I don't know, man. I mean, trouble's gonna find you real soon, so strap in, bud, right?
It's okay. We're gonna open with season 9, and Bobby's just gonna be back, and nobody's gonna acknowledge how it happened, or that he ever died.
Or that he's played by Will Schuster now, apparently.
Or that he's played by Matthew Morris.
You were so mean for that.
I tried my hand at rage baiting on our podcast Twitter by saying that they should recast Bobby with Matthew Morrison. And the tweet didn't get a lot of likes, so I think I failed at rage bait. Well, I guess if it didn't get a lot of likes, it means people didn't like it very much, which is technically succeeding at rage bait.
I did see some people in the comments saying, like, you know, I legit got angry at this for a second or something.
Yay, I succeeded. But yeah, imagine, that's a crazy would you rather. Would you rather have Bobby stay dead, or he's alive but he's been recast as Will Schuster? I think stay dead, 100%. I'm sorry.
Stay dead, 100%. But, like, honestly, like, gun to my head, bullet. Like, I don't leave it up to me. There's a lot of pressure.
But anyway, regardless of that, we cut to Maddie in therapy. She's back in therapy with Frank, and she's talking about how she still doesn't feel free of Doug because, you know, something like her sudden windfall of the marital assets will come up and just put her right back into that trauma. So Frank kind of starts to get to the bottom of it. He's like, do you think you've moved past Doug, or have you just moved around him? Which is an interesting insight. And Maddie talks about how she met Doug when she was 19. So she's lived like so much of her life, almost all of her adult life, kind of defined by her relationship with him. Like, she doesn't totally know who she is outside of him. So Frank is kind of trying to get her to understand a life without Doug, not just after Doug. And he notes that she still refers to him in the present tense, which kind of implies that she hasn't let him go in her brain. And he suggests that Maddie practice some exposure therapy by actually going back to the scene of Doug's death.
Yeah, definitely. And like, she hasn't been back to Big Bear. We get Big Bear again. First of all, this show loves Big Bear, but it, like, does. In a very interesting way. Like, how
big is that bear?
This framing of, like, the place as, like, the scene of Maddie's horrific abuse, it doesn't make me want to go to Big Bear. So I'm not sure what advertisement they're pulling here.
Maybe they were, I wonder if they got sued by the Big Bear Resort for this storyline.
It'd be interesting. But, like, I'm very interested in Maddie's sort of situation here with Doug's memory, because, you know, like you said, he's still very much an active presence in her mind. And it's something we can all kind of understand, is like, even when, you know, someone is out of your life, you know, if they've caused you sufficient trauma, your mind is still going to hover back to them, and you're still going to have that, like, that cortisol shot in your brain and that sinking feeling of your gut when something triggers a thought of them, right? Mm-hmm. And Maddie is like, it's one of those moments where you stop to consider that Maddie is really, like, a very tragic figure, and B, also, like, a very deeply relatable figure for a lot of people, because, you know, she was immediately trapped into this horrible relationship with this man upon turning, you know, 19, and after, you know, escaping her, you know, hellish upbringing with her parents. Right?
Yeah.
Which we'll learn more about down the road. But, like, she hasn't really had the space until now to live a, you know, a fruitful life.
She hasn't really lived, period. She hasn't really lived her life before, like, free of all of this.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, when you like, yell at the screen, like, girl, he's dead, move on, you kind of have to take a step back and
be like, I never yelled that, for the record.
I was, like, taking notes, and, like, I was, like, watching it, and, like, I did have, like, that capturing of that immediate thought of, like, girl, he's in all caps dead. But then I had to stop to myself and reflect on, like, Maddie's, like, you know, the conditions surrounding her life and how much of a tragic figure she truly is. It is honestly, like,
well, yeah, I think it's sort of fair for her to still be upset about it.
But I do love just, like, sort of, like, the idea of that, like, sort of, like, that bitchy Twitter quote tweet attitude of, like, girl, move on, right? Yoko posting a picture of her and John, like, 40 years without you. It's like, girl, move on.
Oh, my God. Well, so, yeah, he suggests going back to Big Bear, which is interesting. I haven't really done exposure therapy before. This seems like a very extreme form of exposure therapy, right? Like, I think there are a lot of different levels this can take, and like it depends on the person and the therapist, like how well it will work. I think we see Maddie be a very good candidate for it in the end, but I feel like I've seen people maybe criticize this storyline because it is like so much to ask of Maddie to go do this really intense thing. But I guess we could just infer that Doug, or oh my God, not Doug, that Frank can tell that she can handle it. But yeah, it definitely depends on the person.
Well, I mean, he is her therapist. He certainly has more like direct insight on her than we do. And you know, to his credit, he does accompany her as well. So she's not going solo.
True.
You know,
true.
She has something to fall back on with them.
It's probably good that he goes with her. But yeah, it's just, it's an interesting example of like some very extreme exposure therapy, just like willingly majorly triggering yourself to try and make some kind of breakthrough.
And like exposure therapy is not for everyone. Like I've seen it like applied to like all sorts of things. This is very much not on the same level, but my biggest fear in the entire world is spiders. I am the worst arachnophobe I've ever met in my life. And I was reading the story about this woman who desensitized herself to her own arachnophobia through a very strange kind of exposure therapy where she just kept a dead tarantula in her purse.
Well, I mean, if it worked for her, then good for her.
And so like she would open her purse and people would be like, ah, what the fuck? And she's like, oh yeah, that's just my little guy.
Oh, it's for therapy. Don't worry, it's for medical reasons.
What I mean to say is Maddie should like keep Doug's head. She should just carry around his head.
She should like freeze his head, like the supposed frozen head of Walt Disney. She should keep his frozen head in her purse.
Yeah, and just carry it around. So she like she's at work and she like goes to open her bag.
Be like, oh, where is my wallet? Oh no, that's just my ex-husband's head.
That would be the Nightmare Before Christmas. That would be great. We actually get a very different strange post-marital thing happening.
Something, I think like Mercury was in retrograde during the events of this Christmas episode because people are out here acting a little crazy because we cut to Athena in bed at home. And someone, the person on the other side of the bed, like, steals her blanket. She assumes it's Bobby, because who else would you assume it to be in your bed rather than the person you typically share your bed with? She's like, oh, don't be greedy. Like, don't steal a blanket. She rolls over. It's not Bobby. It's Michael. It's her gay ex-husband. What is he doing here?
Fucking bed sharing.
We've all asked ourselves that from time to time.
Mythena bed sharing was not on my bingo card for this episode.
Mythena belongs to Maddie and Athena, so jot that down.
It's Mythena, okay? Mythena. Mythena. Mythena bed sharing is crazy. Like, because I've... who is out here writing bed sharing fanfic about Michael and Athena? There's one person, and it's Tim Minear.
No, it's Andrew Myers.
It's Andrew Myers. That's right. It's Andrew Myers. Sorry, Andrew. Sorry, I didn't mean to discredit you. Sorry, Tim. I didn't mean to blame you.
I mean, maybe he was just like being Tim's little ventriloquist puppet. But as far as we know, it was Andrew Myers. Bobby arrives home in the morning because presumably he's been working an overnight shift. And Athena is sleeping on the couch. He's like, what's going on? She tells him about the situation. She says, I didn't have the heart to wake him up and ask what was going on. Like, very kind of her, because I would have been like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, kinder than I would have been, certainly. This is very soapy. This is a very soap opera scenario, isn't it?
I woke up to my gay husband in bed with me.
Next, on Lifetime.
Right. It sounds like also it could be like one of those prompts you get in like a shitty internet ad for like those episodes apps, you know?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, why is my gay husband in bed with me?
What are those, like, those POV TikToks? See, I'm feeling like an old man again. Like a POV TikTok, and, like, someone's doing, like, some weird, like, lip sync scene or something. I don't know.
POV, but I'm your gay ex-husband, and you've just woken up to me in bed with you.
I swear to God, half of the people on that app do not know what POV means. Because why is it never from the POV that they're describing?
Well, anyway, Michael comes out of the bedroom and he says he doesn't even remember arriving the previous night. He says he's been having insomnia and he was prescribed some sleeping pills, and one of the side effects can be sleepwalking, but this seems more extreme than that. So Bobby's like, you might have parasomnia, which is kind of like an extreme form of sleepwalking where people might even, you know, drive, do whatever, go about their days, all while technically being asleep.
Or have sex. Which, by the way, I saw a Law & Order SVU episode that opened with a call about that whole, like, thing.
Oh, really?
It can be a very troubling thing. So I'm not trying to make light of parasomnia. It is a very serious condition. And it has caused harm in the past.
Parasomnia is over, party.
Thank God it didn't go that route. Could you imagine? I choose not to. Michael, he decides that, you know, like his brain basically still compartmentalizes like this house as like his home base. That's probably why he ended up like going back, especially like with the stress of the holidays, like it just triggered something in his brain. And so he makes the executive decision to leave his key and go.
Yeah. Bobby and Athena try to insist that this is still his house. He's still welcome here. But he obviously feels like he's crossed a boundary. He would rather just leave his key. He seems to still be feeling a little angsty. So he just gets out of there quickly.
It's remarkable how kind the both of them are. Like, they are extremely kind to Michael in this exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really is, like, his decision to do this. And you understand why, because, like, you know, even if they're being nice about it, he did still cross a major boundary, even if, you know, it wasn't in his control. If his subconscious is making him do this, that is not okay, and he should remove himself from that situation, you know? So that's a smart call. It's just tough because, like, this is also his children's home, you know? This is also a holiday season.
Yeah, obviously, Athena's being so kind because this is her ex-husband that she's on good terms with, and it is still the... They have, like, this blended family where he's still very much a part of things. Like, he hangs out.
But Buck calls Maddie, and... There's something kind of cryptic at the top of this call where he says, like, I just want to know what she thinks about, like, I don't know, some sort of proposal or whatever. We don't learn the ins and outs of this proposal just yet, but you can surmise that it's relating to something that happens during the climax. And Maddie, she is otherwise occupied because she is going up the road to Big Bear with Frank in the driver's seat. And... Oh boy. God, does Big Bear look different without snow and blood soaking the ground?
It looks a little different in, like, a happy, sunny, safe context. But yeah, they arrive at Big Bear. They're kind of looking at the cabins, and Maddie's like, well, how should we do this? Like, knock on the door? And Frank is like, I think we both know that, like, the cabins here aren't the place where Doug hurt you the most, implying that she should go back to, actually, the woods where the actual death happened. So she starts to walk there. And she's already being heavily triggered. We're seeing, like, flashbacks to it all. But she gets there and she just starts speaking her truth to Doug, kind of very, like, quickly and succinctly, is like, I forgive you and myself. I forgive myself for loving you too much, for staying too long, and for not dying next to you. And she says she's just gonna leave him here. She's gonna leave these woods and live her life. And finally, she says, I survived you, Doug, and I will never be sorry for that. And like I said, it's kind of like there's a part of it that feels a little rushed just because it is like this kind of big emotional moment that's happening kind of very quickly and neatly. At the same time, I think this scene is effective. I thought it was nice and emotional seeing her do this.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Like, it is kind of jarring how quickly she arrives at this conclusion. But, I mean, like, we're 20 minutes into the episode and we have a lot of ground to cover. So I understand why they'd want to, you know, make it as punchy and impactful as they can with the time they had.
It seems like maybe this storyline could have benefited a little from being in a lighter episode with, like, more room to breathe, where this could have been, like, the A plot. But because it's this Christmas episode, it has to be happening alongside, like, 15 other people's storylines. So, you know, I think it works in the end. But yeah, there's part of me that wishes they could have dwelt on this for a little longer.
But, you know, she runs up that hill and it is very powerful and a very moving scene. Mm-hmm. And it's a good model for, you know, sort of moving on from these traumatic incidents. That's something that I liked about this episode, is that there were moments that felt like really sort of didactic, but not in a preachy way. You know what I mean? It felt like they were presenting a case of like, we're going to handle this responsibly and be sort of a good role model for people in this scenario. It felt like what Degrassi was really good at when they handled big issues responsibly.
That's always something I've really liked, maybe partly because I love Degrassi so much. But I've always really liked this show's impulse to do a similar thing where, yeah, they model good emotional behavior. You know, they sort of give you a textbook example of something to try and set a positive example. Because I know that sometimes that can come off very cheesy, but often I think it can be genuinely good. And sometimes I think like TV shows could benefit from having more of that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And there was like another moment like right after this that I also sort of identified as a good thing that I kind of want to have a PSA on when we get to it. It's actually in the next scene because Maddie gets sort of the closure that she needs, and then we go to back in LA. There's this little kid, right, who's, you know, he's greasing up his widowed mom with a mac and cheese and hot dog dinner, just like dad used to make. Yeah, so he basically, the thing about this kid, because mom comes home, she's impressed with the dinner, and turns out it's a bargaining tactic, right? Like I said, he's greasing her up because he is deduced through his own powers of sort of like rationalism, deductive reasoning, etc. Santa's not real. He is 10. He's too old for this stuff. But mom is pushing back. She likes pretending. They don't have to pretend, but she likes pretending because, like I said, Jane, this goes back to the mall Santa thing, December is the only magical month left in the year for a child of this age, you know, or even an adult of this age who's getting to do this vicariously sort of like through her kid or, you know, as an activity with her kid. You know, the rest is just like cold, hard world with dead husband, dead dad, presumably. And, you know, she gets this 1 month out of the year to go full Santa Claus, full Christmas, and she's, God damn it, she's going to make it happen. If it kills her. Oh no, it might kill her.
Yes, right after saying that she wants to keep pretending Santa is real so that they can keep experiencing the magic of the season, the mom starts experiencing some clear discomfort. She's having like some chest pain. And let's be real, the last thing you want to do in that situation is eat a big plate of mac and cheese with hot dogs. Yeah. But before she can even try, she collapses and the kid has to call 911.
Yeah. Absent a cardiac incident, I will eat a plate of Kraft mac and cheese and sliced hot dogs any day of the week. That sounds fantastic.
Oh yeah, I'm not trying to knock it. I'm just saying, like, of all things to like give you heartburn, make your chest feel tight, I feel like that's up there.
Yeah, but that, but this kid, he's prepared in a sense because he gives his name, he gives his address. He knows his address very well. When I was 10, I did not know my address for shit. If I had to call 911, people would die. Okay.
I feel like parents and schools usually try to like get it in your head that you should know your own address, but I guess they skipped you, buddy. Sorry.
Listen, perks of being a latchkey kid, okay?
I was too, but I feel like to be a latchkey kid, you have to know your address that you have the key to, right?
I mean, I took the bus.
This kid has better survival skills than child Ryan.
I mean, it's true. Facts are facts.
Yeah, Maddie is on the other line. She gets this kid, his name is Leo. She gets him to check if the mom is breathing. She's not. And finally, Maddie's like, I'm going to instruct you to do CPR. Like, he's scared, but she can talk him through it. So they start doing that. He starts doing chest compressions, hears something crack, and is worried that maybe he's hurt her. But Maddie's like, no, that means it's working. Keep going.
Yeah. This, and I will say his rhythm game is off. She's not like guiding him through the proper BPM, but that's kind of normal of shows. They don't actually do a proper like in-depth like breakdown of how to do CPR. But I do. Yeah. This is another one of those moments that I appreciate because everyone should know how to do CPR. And yes, I am talking to you, listener. You should know how to do CPR. So I am going to tell you how to do CPR. Okay.
Okay. I'll do it on myself right now. I'll follow along. I'll break my own sternum.
I took a community emergency response team class in high school. I think I've talked about this before, but part of our training for that was we learned CPR. We learned a bunch of very useful skills in case of an emergency like this. And so first thing you want to do, roll the person on their back and check their airway. If it's obstructed by anything, they're choking on food or whatever. If you have a way of clearing it, do so. Now, very important to note that unless the person is choking or drowning, which caused the loss of consciousness, caused them to stop breathing, you don't need to do mouth to mouth. It is right. not recommended because it just detracts from the actual act of resuscitating them.
But what if the person you're doing CPR on is like the person you've had a complicated, like almost love story with, and this is your one chance to kiss them?
You get one. You get one, okay? You as a treat. I'm just kidding. You get one. So
picturing like how we could turn this into a buddy NDE.
I feel like that would be great. That would be very. Who's giving mouth to mouth in that scenario?
No, like,
I feel
like it's Buck. I have been saying this for years in my head. I think it's Eddie. I think that'd be more interesting. But let's not go there. Continue.
Yeah, let's not go there. Because you know, once you've checked their airway, if it's obstructed. And presuming you don't know how to operate an AED or you don't have one near you, identify where their heart is on their body, like on their sternum, with your thumb, and then close your hands over it. Your dominant hand should be making contact with their sternum, and your non-dominant hand should be above it, applying force. You position yourself in a 90-degree angle over that person who, again, is lying flat on their back, and you push down. You push down with straight arms. Okay, it is very common in these scenarios for the sternum to crack. That is what the kid heard in this scenario. That is normal. Like Maddie said, that just means it's working. Keep doing what you're doing.
And that's kind of a nice thing for them to show, because I feel like most TV shows, when people do CPR, like it yeah. always just, you know, for one thing, the actors are obviously not pressing as hard as they would have to in real life, because you don't want to actually hurt yeah. whatever actor is in the scene, but also so it already looks like gentler than it would in real life. And then they never yeah. acknowledge that, yeah, you actually could hurt somebody while doing it, but like that's not as yeah. important as getting their heart beating again.
And it should be a very noticeable push too. It shouldn't be one of those like bitchy little wimpy pushes you see in media. Like it should be a noticeable push down, right? One of the most important parts of this is that your heart pumps blood through your body between 100 and 120 beats per minute. There are a lot of pop songs that have that very tempo. So it's very common to when you're practicing CPR to train your rhythm on one of those songs by like singing it or humming it along or even just like playing it in your head, right? So common songs.
Which Lady Gaga song should we use?
Just Dance. Genuinely, okay. Just Dance.
That's a great one.
There is a good list. There are many lists online. So if you need a reference, I'm going to give you a couple. So Just Dance by Lady Gaga, feat. Colby O'Donis. We can't forget. The classic one that they always say is Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. If you right. know it, you probably do. But I feel like people of our generation is maybe a little less accessible. So we have Dancing Queen by ABBA is within that range. Hips Don't Lie by Shakira. Mmm-bop by Hanson. Mmm-bop, chick-chop-bop, oom-wop, sip-a-dop-bop, doo-wop. That one can be tricky because of all the staccato, but, you know, it's fine. Another one, Bites the Dust by Queen. Jane, you'll remember that one. Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, okay? Work It by Missy Elliott. And the one that I always used, in my cert class, was Crazy in Love by Beyonce. I think that Ooh. One is far and away the easiest. So, and it's also far and away the most accessible because everyone knows that fucking song. Pick a song from that list. And then if, God forbid, you're in a situation where you have to do CPR, lean back on that. But the most important thing, of course, is to call 911 and get people on the way.
Well, I personally think the most important part is to pick a good song, because I think it's like whenever you're in a situation where you might have to do CPR, it's like everybody in the room could probably use a bit of a mood boost, right?
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, you should have like a pretty fire playlist when you're dying, right? Like if I'm slipping off to like off of this mortal coil, I'm going to want to hear a little B. I'm going to want to hear a little Gaga, a little Shakira, a little Nirvana. Just to send me off properly.
Yeah, like if the CPR is not going to work, at least you got to, you know, jam out a little bit one last time. So yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's a very good PSA, especially for the kids at home who might be watching 911 with their like grandma who makes them sit down and watch this show with them.
Oh, God. If we have any kids listening to us, by the way, I claim no responsibility for you, like no shade. But if you're under 18 listening to this podcast, I have no responsibility to that. We advertise it as mature for a reason.
Let me check our Spotify stats. age. 2.9% of our Spotify listeners say they're in the 0 to 17 category.
All right, well, let's hope they're on the high end of that.
Or the low end, because if they're 0 years old, they probably can't understand what we're saying anyway. Shout out to all our baby listeners.
We're training the next generation. Goo goo gaga. Am I right, guys?
Goo goo gaga, guys. Shout out to all our listeners who are 0 years old. Yeah. But finally, the sirens start approaching. The 118 arrives, and they take over the first aid. You know, Bobby takes the kid outside. Hen starts doing CPR. And finally, after some CPR and some defibrillating, the mom's pulse comes back. They get her back. They wheel her out, but the kid is just forced to, like, watch and cry because, as we hear when Hen comes out to talk to him, he thinks he's in trouble because the cops wouldn't let him go with his mom in the ambulance. Which,
a sweet kid.
Why? Oh, you know, I guess they need, like, an official guardian from, like, CFS to be with him before he can, like, go, because I guess his mom's unconscious, so, like, technically he's sort of unsupervised if he's
that's
in the
probably
ambulance
why
with her.
Yeah,
that's what I would assume. Mm-hmm. But it still feels like, come on, why can't he just be in the ambulance with his mom, or at least be like driven to the hospital by someone?
Well, it's also that's the part is what I was thinking about, because, like, yeah, you know, he should be allowed to, like, see his mom if she does end up dying, right? But also, like, maybe it's a play on the ambulance, you know, the EMT's parts, to not traumatize this kid while he's forced to watch in close proximity while getting this constant sensory overload as they work to save her life.
Or, like, if the mom crashes again in the ambulance and dies, like, you don't really want the kid to be in there while they're dealing with that. But
I mean, he's 10 years old. You don't want him to see his mom die. That's awful, especially since he clearly, I mean, his dad seems to be dead, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. This kid's not having a great life so far. But, you know, Hen reassures him, like, you're not in trouble, obviously, and your mom's going to be fine, whatever. A cop arrives to kind of take over Hen's role and sit with the kid until Children and Family Services can get there.
I'm side-eyeing this cop right away. I am side-eyeing this cop right away. She better play so nice. She better be so good with this kid.
Yeah.
Don't trust her at all.
But the cop wishes Hen a Merry Christmas, and Hen, you know, gives her the same back. But you can tell that Hen is not really feeling that Christmas spirit after what she's just witnessed.
It's crazy that we go from that to 30 times the glass was not strong enough.
Like, okay, in my opinion, this scene out of context is so hilarious.
It's so funny. This is like the perfect 911 out of context, like, compilation.
Literally. So Michael is at the mall or something. He's disoriented and hypersensitive to stimuli. He's, like, walking around in a stupor. We're seeing, you know, they've made the screen blurry with editing to communicate that he's disoriented. He seems, like, sensitive to light and to sounds. I was thinking, like, for people who get overstimulated easily, this is just what the mall experience is like on any day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. Are you kidding me? Especially if it's hot out. Like, it's
just what life
in LA.
Is like for, like, some people.
Do you ever get so hot that you get nauseous? Like, I get that all, especially when I'm like waiting in lines after I've just gone shopping. I'm just like, oh my God, get me out of here.
Michael is so disoriented, so overstimmied, that he walks straight through the glass door of the mall. And this is where I wrote in my notes, I'm sorry, out of context, this is extremely funny. There's just some, like, obviously, you know, obviously we know from context that something is going on with Michael. But
no, in context, this is extremely funny.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it is kind of funny in context, too. Especially because so far the episode has been playing kind of coy with, like, they have been telling us that, like, this could all be explained away by just him, like, kind of being sad about the holidays, you know? So it's really funny to imagine that, like, oh, he was so sad about, like, his first Christmas away from the kids or whatever, that he walks through a glass door by accident.
And, you know, so he gets patched up at the hospital, of course, and who should come to take him home but one Athena Krant, who was at one point legally his wife and leverages that to get backstage, as it were. And, you know, like you said, they're sort of playing coy with this whole thing. It's like, why isn't he sleeping well? Why is he having to take this medication? Oh, well, it's his first Christmas alone. It's an emotional experience. And we get an excellent performance from Rockman in this scene. It's like one of those, like, where you can tell the actor's, like, trying to hold back their emotions, and, like, they let little bits of it out, like, at a time. And then it sort of culminates in you know, them telling them that, like, they love each other platonically, of course, but they really, really still deeply care about each other. He breaks down and she comforts him. It's oh my God, it's so sweet.
Yeah, she's like, you're not alone. You'll never be alone. And Michael agrees to get checked out by a doctor for real, like, as soon as the holidays are over, basically, because Athena's been kind of confronting him in this scene about, like, clearly something's going on with you. Like, all of these things have to be related. She's starting to worry that something more serious medically could be wrong with him.
Yeah, Michael, what is going on with you? Jesus Christ, get it together, man. Come on. You got kids at home. It's not the time.
You've got boyfriend at home, question mark? We don't know, because the show never shows us.
I don't even think boyfriend. I think he is lonely. I'm going to be honest. I think he hasn't felt the touch of a man in a while.
Grant broke up with him. Or no, it wasn't Grant. Oh, my God. I always wanted to call his old boyfriend Grant. But no, that's his surname.
Yeah.
Two beautiful bald gay men getting married, and one of them is named Grant. Yeah, it was Glenn.
My name is Gail Waters. My husband and I had the same last name, but I insisted on hyphenating.
Yeah, but we then cut to another beautiful married couple, except these ones are still married and they're both gay. Hen and Karen are at home getting presents down from the attic. Hen is telling Karen about this sad story of the little boy from today at work, how he'll be in a group home, she's heard, until his mom is out of the hospital. So over Christmas, which obviously is a sad way to spend the holidays if you're a little kid. They finish unpacking gifts and realize they've kind of lost track and ended up buying Denny an exorbitant amount of gifts. They've got, it's kind of like, you remember in Harry Potter, the first one when, okay, sorry to bring up Harry Potter in 2025 after everything that's happened, but remember how, like, Dudley gets, like, 40 birthday presents or something?
I'm going to take your word for it.
Okay, well, there's a thing in the first one where he's like, why did you guys only get me, like, 39 presents this year instead of 40? And it's like, wow, look at that entitled little guy.
Yeah, I know. I believe you. I'm not saying this, like, to be, like, shitty or anything about, like, oh, I'm morally superior because I don't like Harry Potter. I just genuinely never liked Harry Potter. So that is totally within the realm of things that I, like, could imagine. But I have no idea.
I was a Harry Potter kid. I come from a Harry Potter family. So it's all very ingrained in my mind.
Like, you could say, like, Dudley got, like, a giraffe and a water park for Christmas, and I would believe you. Because that seems like something J.K. Rowling would write.
Well, he did get put into a snake enclosure because of Harry's burgeoning magic powers. Anyway, this isn't important. They've gotten Denny an exorbitant amount of gifts, and Hen wonders aloud if Denny would have ended up someplace like a group home himself if she and Karen hadn't stepped in to adopt him. So she's obviously really empathizing with this little boy. And then we go to Athena in bed at home. Luckily, Michael is not there this time. Bobby comes in, her real current husband, and he says that his test results came in and he's clear across the board. So say it with me, guys. Why did it even matter?
Why did it even matter?
Like, I'm sorry, but, you know, why did we even do this storyline right before the mid-season finale if it was going to result in literally nothing?
Can I ask a physiological question?
Sure.
Why did Bobby's nose bleed?
I mean, any number of things. I guess we could just infer that maybe it was a dry day and he got a regular nosebleed. Or maybe it was his dormant radiation poisoning that would end up killing him when he was exposed to Crimean Congo fever several seasons later.
I like to think that it was his magic blood in a last-ditch attempt for attention, saying, hey, guys, I'm here too. I hope you didn't forget about me.
We can assume that as well, for sure.
It's like, I love, like, the idea of, like, his blood cells, like, you know, like, under the underbelly of Bobby's immune system. They were, like, you know, like, they were putting this plan together for years. And finally, in, like, a very, like, you know, high pressure moment, we'll make our appearance. And then everyone will finally remember us. And it's like, oh, no. Sorry.
Sorry.
Bobby and his sentient magical blood.
But anyway, Bobby is excited for Christmas Eve because, oh my God, romantic. It's the night Athena said yes to marrying him. Mm-hmm. I had already forgotten that that's what happened at the end of last year's Christmas episode, that he proposed.
They have lived 1,000 lives since then.
No, literally. Athena has a very horny line. mm-hmm. where she says something like, we've still got about 5 hours until that alarm goes off. Let's see what else I might be willing to say yes to. I was like, girl, this show is not very raunchy usually.
Hey, we fap into Superman.
And also, I feel like that's kind of a weird way to say, like, I want to have sex with you right now.
Well, I, for me, I would get stressed out because I'm like, you're reminding me that I only have 5 hours to sleep before my next day starts. Like, sorry, good night.
That, but also you're kind of invoking consent and sort of making it seem like you just say yes to things I want to do. You know, that's the part that would stress me out.
Interesting. Interesting. So we went different directions with it. My objection was very utilitarian in the sense that, like,
right.
you know, I have 5 hours of sleep. You're not getting nothing from me tonight.
Damn. We would both be terrible, terrible partners.
Terrible lovers of Angela Bassett, yes.
Yeah, we would not appreciate her for all she is. But
hey, she can come on the pod and we can work it out, okay?
We cut to a woman alone at Christmas with a terrible toothache. She's talking to her bitch mom on the phone. She's like annoyed with her stupid mom. She has to work during Christmas and her tooth hurts like a son of a bitch. So she's not having a very good Christmas. She's looking through her medicine cabinet for another tube of benzocaine. She has apparently already gone through a lot of it and she squeezes out a truly crazy amount to put on her tooth.
I have no idea what benzocaine is.
I guess it's just like a topical pain relief thing that you can put on your tooth or something like that.
Yeah, it seems like she has like a root canal or something. I thought that it was gonna be like a twist, like, oh, it's super glue and she has to get her she has to get like a solvent. But no, it's worse. She wakes up the next day and she has silver poisoning. She's having a blue Christmas. Might I just say, blue Christmas needle drop?
Yes, blue Christmas needle drop, because of course this lady has turned blue. We get a classic 911 call where she says, I'm blue. And the dispatcher's like, feelings of depression are common around the holidays. Let me direct you to the mental health hotline. And she says, no, damn it. I'm literally blue.
Okay, Smurfette.
She literally makes a Smurf reference in the next scene.
She makes an Avatar reference. It's like she's going
oh,
through
yeah,
the whole
thing.
They're
milking it for all it's worth.
You know what I mean? Like, and
she is giving Neytiri. She's giving Navi. She's giving
Zoe
Jake
Saldana.
Sully.
Yes.
I'm trying to just remember the names of other characters from Avatar, which is always a difficult task. Am I right?
She's giving a boy named Spider.
Giving a boy named Spider, except not really, because he was the one who wasn't blue, because he was just a little human man.
And she's breaking down. The 118's there, and she's like, I have to go to work. I mean, what kind of loser has to work on Christmas?
And they all kind of look at each other, because obviously, for the 118 to be here, they must be working on Christmas. She says, look at me, I'm a Smurf. And I need a root canal. I just liked the writing of this scene. I like how much of a loser this lady is and how much she acknowledges it.
Oh, I was just going to say, she's having hashtag her worst day ever.
She is kind of having her hashtag worst day ever. And it's happening on Christmas, so that's never good. But it was kind of giving that girl in the last episode who is, you know, at her lowest point and then she gets impaled by a meteor. I feel like... I feel like she is probably at a similar point in her life where she's like at her lowest point. But this could maybe be the thing that kind of gets her out of her funk. Although they don't really depict that happening.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, this won't make her rich and famous like the meteor striking her would, because this is unfortunately a very well-known publicized condition. Like, I was immediately reminded of the case of a Bellingham native. So, you know, Washington hometown hero. His name is Paul Karasin, and he went on Today to advocate for his longtime use of a substance called colloidal silver. Which is a classic remedy for everything from arthritis to, you know, like acid reflux to, and I shit you not, HIV.
And by classic, we mean obvious snake oil grift.
Absolute pseudoscience. And by the way, prolonged use of it turns your skin blue. Paul Karasin is dead.
Does it also turn you dead?
I mean, silver poisoning, it's dangerous. I mean, he was also a heavy smoker, so he died of lung cancer. But that's besides
the point. Double homicide.
double homicide. And this lady, you know, they go to take her blood, and she's Buck asks, why is she bleeding chocolate syrup? And Chimney, he's so sassy, he goes, because blood thinner boy.
Which you might think this is sassy of him, but recall back in season one, Buck referred to Chimney as Ayo Rebar. So I feel like Buck has owed him one ever since.
Yeah, Chimney, he definitely earned that that little jab.
But basically, Chimney explains what's going on. You know, it's something about like benzocaine kind of stops the production of red blood cells. So she's like not getting enough oxygen to her blood cells. It's all this whole thing. And it turns out
hemoglobin builds
it,
up everything.
Yeah. The way to reverse it is by giving her methylene blue, which ironically you'd think that would be the thing to turn her blue. But no, the substance itself is blue. So they inject her with that. It reverses the effects. She ends up coming to and she kind of turns back into a normal color. Not to imply that people who are blue aren't normal, okay? I am not anti-Navi.
I'm not anti-Navi either. I'm anti those movies because I think they're bad.
Oh, I'm pro those movies. I think they're awesome. I think it's awesome that we have like one big stupid franchise that was actually created in the 21st century instead of being just like a shameless, soulless nostalgia milker.
No, it is very much like an auteur's project. You know what I mean? And I can respect it on that ground. I love like the cultural backslide to thinking Avatar is good again that we've seen in the last like 5 years.
And I am one of those people because I think that is far less tiresome than the people who have been making the same joke for years and years and years that like, oh, isn't it funny that those movies make a ton of money at the box office, but then nobody remembers them? It's like, oh, you think you're funny? You think you're so cool? Should we have a party? Should we invite James Cameron? Should we?
I don't think James Cameron would like that party. I'm going to be very honest with you.
Should we invite Zack Snyder? Should we?
I would go to that party. He's hot. Okay.
I would
ask him about life, right?
But anyhow, Bobby is back at the station after this, and who should surprise him but Athena. She is up on the second level, and it turns out she is surprising him with a surprise Christmas party. Yas. Everything worked out. All of their friends and family are there, including Christopher. I think there's kind of a funny detail here where the guests like all yell surprise as the 118 are coming up the stairs, and Christopher and Abuela are like front and center, like very much in view of the firefighters who are like coming to the top of the stairs, entering this room. And yet it's not till like 5 seconds later that Eddie like walks halfway through the room and then is like, Christopher, you're here. Like, I think it's just like the way they've shot and edited it. It's like impossible to believe that Eddie wouldn't have seen Christopher as soon as everybody yelled surprise. So that was my little like nitpick funny thing about this scene.
I don't blame Eddie for that because I was completely distracted by the fact that Denny is dressed like Sue Sylvester in this scene. I'm so brain poisoned because Denny is wearing a red tracksuit and I cannot see a red Nike tracksuit without immediately going to Jane Lynch, right?
I guess that's Emmy
winner Jane Lynch, okay? and so I that's just where my eye went. I'm like, oh Jesus, you think this is hard? Try having a blue Christmas. That's hard.
Cue the Rory needle drop. But
please.
But it should also be noted that as Eddie and Christopher are reuniting, you can see in the background Buck is fondly watching the two of them from afar, which could mean nothing.
Nothing at all.
We hear that Buck organized this whole thing and Karen arranged for the group home kids, all the kids who are at this group home with Leo, including Leo, to come to the Christmas party. Like, she talked to the social worker. She also mentions that the group home social worker told her that there's a serious overcrowding problem right now because there just aren't enough foster parents to go around. So, of course, Hen kind of tentatively asks if they should consider fostering. And it turns out Karen is way ahead of her and has already booked them an appointment with the social worker. And she says, you know, there's more than one way to have a family, right? So that's kind of a nice inevitable resolution to her storyline with Hen and having more kids. I feel like from the moment it became clear that they would not be having biological children, it kind of became a thing in the back of your mind of like, okay, they're probably going to like adopt or foster some kids knowing them.
It's funny how few people like actually jump to the idea of adopting or fostering kids. Mm-hmm. It does seem it's strange to me because I guess my brain is also kind of warped because like as a gay person, unless I wanted to go the surrogacy route, adopting kids is like, you know, the only route to that like process of like raising a child that I would have.
You wouldn't go the mpreg route?
I wouldn't go the mpreg route because like you have to get into like the whole like are you gonna get or like, you know, what if it happens when we're not expecting it,
which of us is the alpha, which one is the omega,
do we have to go to the place, like if it's just not the right time, like I don't want to deal with that. And so like my brain like immediately jumps to like fostering kids, adopting kids when I think about the process of like raising a child. And so it is kind of funny to me when other people don't have that same automatic response.
Although for the record, Hen and Karen are gay, so, and they do have one adopted child already, so
that's the thing, they adopted Denny, so it's not like a strange leap in logic, and like
it is
the logical conclusion of the story, so I'm glad they went that route.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was funny, right? Because like you see this with straight couples all the time, like I don't know if like they're, you know, too egotistical to adopt or they're just like it just hasn't crossed their mind, like, you know, but it's true, like I've talked to like straight people who are like very like upset that they can't have biological kids because that is a very, you know, emotionally devastating thing to learn, that, you know, your body isn't capable of that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when that's something that you want.
But yeah, I get what you're saying, like the fact that people don't immediately consider like kind of equally weighing both options, because it's also like, I mean, my perspective is that pregnancy has always seemed so horrifying to me. No offense to anyone who is pregnant or wants to get pregnant or has been pregnant.
I just found out my cousin is pregnant, actually, so I won't show her this episode.
Oh yeah, I have had several pregnant cousins, and I have two pregnant cousins right now. I have always thought for myself that prospect does not sound very appealing. So I'm kind of surprised that more like women in particular, people who can have like give birth, that there hasn't been more of a movement of like considering adoption and fostering more, if anything, just to like avoid birthing children. I get it.
Well, that's why I like, you know, shows like The Fosters or like movies like the first Shazam movie, because I appreciated like why, you know, like how they depicted
the first Shazam movie is what society needs right now.
Hey, I liked that movie. I hate Zachary Levi, but I liked the movie. And
right.
what I really like resonate with in those is like, you know, a very like sort of honest and also homely depiction of like a foster family. You know what I mean? And like giving that sort of thing like attention in like sort of a media landscape that seems like almost strangely hostile to the idea. Like you never really, you don't see a lot of media about adopting kids or about fostering kids.
Well, I've noticed that in a lot of movies, foster care will be treated like the worst place a kid can end up, you know, which obviously there is like a track record of a lot of kids do suffer in foster care if it's the wrong situation. But like, yeah, I think it could be good to show a positive example as well. Like, come to think of it, you know, the first Step Up movie is we see Channing Tatum in foster care. And I guess it's not treated like a horrible thing for him. Like, he's got like a nice foster sister that he likes, played by Alison Stoner. But like, you know, he doesn't seem to have a great relationship with his foster parents. His foster dad is like kind of a mean drunk or whatever. So it doesn't really, it kind of feels like it's meant, they put him in foster care to further illustrate how much of a rough upbringing he has.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm like, I'm grateful to this show for dwelling on this, because, you know, it is such a large and under-discussed facet of society. Like, you know, I can just say that here in New York, you know, a lot of, you know, people who, you know, are homeless, they enter those conditions because they age out of the foster care system and they don't get adopted into families and support systems and networks like that.
Yeah.
And so, like, I really wish more people would adopt kids. Because there are a lot of kids, you know, in the foster care system. There are a lot of kids up for adoption that need homes.
Way more kids that need adopting than people who are interested in adopting.
Yeah. It's like that's like the angle that, like, you know, you hear like, you know, time and again, but people don't really dwell on it, that like this could be an option for me. So yeah, I'm really glad that they're depicting this in this way. I also wrote in my notes when Karen was bringing up the idea, Karen is fostering an idea. To just dwell
good
on
one,
that.
Ryan. Good
Thank
one.
You. Thank you.
But then we see Chimney descending the stairs to meet Maddie, who, another amazing Christmas surprise has brought Leo's mom from the hospital to come be with him on Christmas. We hear that, like, you know, they were going to discharge her tomorrow anyway, and so she fought tooth and nail to get to spend Christmas with her boy, and Leo runs down and greets her. It's very sweet. They, like, run up to the party together. Maddie is wearing a Santa hat in this scene, which I thought was kind of funny because then she and Chimney start talking about a very serious thing, which is her exposure therapy. Chimney asks her how it went. She's like, it wasn't easy, but she finally feels free. She feels like she finally let go. So they go join the party and they are happy now. They do a little twirl. It's very cute.
Look at that Christmas ham on the table. Okay, you cannot look at that Christmas ham and tell me that they did not make the right choice with this party. That's all I'm saying. That is a delectable looking ham. I want a slice.
Okay, well, Buck wanted turkey, so...
Okay, well, Buck doesn't get what he wants. Buck is
stupid.
Imagine
if he started complaining because it was a ham and not a turkey. But also, it's funny that Buck was advocating for that so hard when, like, in real life, Oliver Stark is a vegan. So you know that they probably gave him, like, vegan food on a plate for him to eat in this scene.
Mm-hmm. And we see the kids on the couches and, like, the lounge area, and May and Harry, like, May turns into, like, Mayo Claus. Like, she brings a bunch of gifts over. They open their presents. Angela is looking stunning in this Santa red blouse that she's wearing. It is so cute, so flattering. And she says something very funny, which is, you know, Buck, you know, he organized this whole thing with her, with Athena. And Athena says, you know, Buck has a pretty good head on his shoulders. His New Year's resolution should be to use it for good rather than evil.
I know. I thought it was funny. Like, obviously they have had their beef before, but I was also kind of like, when has he ever used it for evil? Have we seen that before?
Maybe it's her perspective on the lawsuit thing. I don't know.
Yeah, true. True.
I love the painting that as evil.
I had a funny thought during this scene, which is, like, they're lucky that no calls seem to be happening during this party. Or maybe they are getting calls, but they just forced only the B shift to work right now. It's like only main characters get to attend the Christmas party.
There's like a cast system, and like the actual cast is on top, and then the B shift is like out here doing the manual labor. That's awful.
They're like, I haven't gotten to spend a Christmas with my family in 15 years. But, you know, it's all fine. It's all worth it as long as those two white men get to have their father figure relationship.
He probably drives that, you know, fire truck more than he drives the family minivan. It's a tough life, you know.
Aww.
But we see, you know, watching over this scene, Michael Grant looking like he's going to kill himself. Michael
is looking troubled
and sad, you know, watching over this whole thing. It's like,
so Bobby being the Good Samaritan and Michael's epic bro, he walks over and talks to him, tries to ask him what's going on with him. Michael's like, in a very ominous way, he's like, yeah, I'm doing great. And the family is so great. And, you know, we're all so lucky to have found each other. He's just got this somber tone, even though he's saying all these nice things. And Bobby asks him what's going on. And Michael says the doctors did some scans at the hospital the other day and they found a tumor in his brain. And, you know, he tells Bobby to keep it to himself until Michael is ready to tell the rest of the family. He wants to have Christmas untainted. And that's kind of where we leave things. And I have to say, I'm sorry, but this storyline never does anything for me. Just because
really?
It's so disconnected. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
It's
tell
so disconnected from everything else on the show. You know, like, it's like I've said before, I think they struggle to have Michael truly feel like a part of the cast because he's not, like, in a first responder profession. And so, yeah. I don't know, for me, having Michael suddenly have a random medical condition just doesn't feel like drama I really care about on a show like this. Like, I don't mean to sound callous, but I'm like, why do I care that Athena's ex-husband has a brain tumor? Like,
I care.
To be clear, I've been liking Michael more on this, like, attentive podcast rewatch than I think I have on my watch throughs before. Like, I've been seeing more of his good moments, so I don't, like, dislike him at this point, but I'm just feeling like he's too much in the periphery right now for me to really feel like this is a worthwhile storyline. It's kind of like if you told me, like, yeah, Buck's grandma isn't doing so well right now, I'd be like, oh, well, that's too bad, you know, but, like, I don't know that you could ask me to care about, like, a storyline about that. I don't know her like that, which I know is an unfair comparison because obviously Michael is a character on the show. I'm not trying to downplay his involvement on the show, but like,
I see what you're saying.
He's not part of the storylines usually. And so I struggle to find this that compelling. I think maybe they were trying to do a bit of like an emotional bait and switch by having, you know, this threat of cancer for Bobby. And then it turns out he's in the clear, but someone else they care about is not. But I guess I don't think that's compelling enough just with the character, with the role that Michael has on the show.
Well, I totally like see like how you would arrive at that and mm-hmm. like how that would sit for you. I guess what makes it work for me is that bait and switch. Like, that's what kind of made the whole Bobby thing like work a little bit more than I thought it would. Like if it was just like Bobby's fine, then I would totally be like, who cares? But I actually appreciated that Michael, who's been like kind of a steady presence on the show, the bait and switch was, you know, Bobby was thinking he was sick, but now it actually turns out that it's Michael. I appreciated that, you know, Michael is like upended in this way because he has been such a steady side presence, and now he's getting main character treatment in this way. Right. So that's why it sort of worked for me, especially like reversing the roles on Michael and Bobby. Now Bobby has to be Michael's support system. And you know, going from that to like the
but I feel like we've seen that before. Like, you know, when he had his breakup with Glenn, not Grant, you know, Bobby was there for Michael, which I'm not saying that's on the same scale as him having cancer, but like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like that much of a role reversal to me.
Well, what I liked was like it has that like sort of like the other shoe just dropped moment into this like happy, smiley, like sort of like landscape, like a photo of all the families there for the Christmas dinner and everyone's smiling. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated sort of the like the dark, dissonant tone of that. And so I feel like it was the execution that made it work for me personally, even though like on paper, if I was just like reading like the series of events, I would probably agree with you. I think I was just like, I think I just appreciated like sort of like the tone they were going with the storyline. And so that's what sold it for me.
And that's what's great about the First Risk podcast is that we don't always feel the same way about a storyline, but we can hear each other out.
This is a place of ideas, okay? This is a place of community.
Exactly. This is
and
the marketplace of ideas, you might even say.
One might say this is the only true free marketplace of ideas, okay? Fuck Tommy Kennard.
And on that note, another brilliant and successful episode of the podcast. Good job, Ryan. I think we did great.
I agree. We kept it succinct. And honestly, I was happy to talk about it because I feel like this episode, I enjoyed it a lot more than I have maybe like the last few episodes. And I felt it like gave way to a lot of fruitful conversation. So I appreciated
that. I agree. I think this is one of the better ones of the season so far. I was entertained the whole time. I thought there was lots of good comedy, but lots of effective emotional stuff as well.
Yeah. Good Christmas episode. Good holiday episode. And I always enjoy a Christmas in July. I weirdly feel more interested in the holiday during like the summer seasons, because like I'm like, I love winter so much and I hate summer. Like, summer sucks for me. It's too sunny, it's too warm, everyone's too happy, like there's so much pressure to go out and have fun.
Well, can I say that was kind of a disorienting thing about this episode to me, is I, especially as a Minnesotan, whenever I see like Christmas media set in a place like LA, it feels so disjointed to me because it's like, why are all these people in like tank tops at the mall? It feels so weird because you have like everybody in summer clothes, but then there's like Santa is in the mall, you know, or like Christmas trees are everywhere. It feels like a pale imitation of the real Christmas. Like, it's just cosplaying as Christmas. So that's what I have to say about warm places, is you guys are posers when it comes to Christmas.
That'd be an interesting, actually, like sort of Patreon bonus video would be like, what are like some of our favorite like Christmas episodes of TV shows and like why, right? Because I love a Christmas episode. I really do.
I don't know if I could even think of enough. We would just end up talking about the Glee Christmas episodes and the Degrassi Christmas episodes. The Glee
rank the Glee Christmas episodes.
I mean, the order is already so obvious to anyone who's anyone. But anyway, guys, speaking of the Patreon, do check out the Patreon. We have two bonus episodes up now. One is about the masterpiece, The Boy Next Door. The other is about gay Eddie and sort of debating his sexuality in the court of public opinion and a fictional court of law. And our bonus episode topic poll is about to close, or probably has closed by the time this episode will be out. And the last time I checked, it was a neck and neck tie between watching Lifetime first responder movies, which sounds fun to me, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna enjoy that.
And pitching our version of 911 season 9. So that's very exciting because I love both of those ideas. So I'm excited to talk about it.
I think that's going to be fun. I'm excited about that. I will say I did love that comment that we had on the Patreon topic poll. That was like, when will the first respond cast submit to ranked choice voting?
Yeah, I forgot to hit. I'll do it next time. There is an option for like multiple choice voting at least, which is closer to that, I think.
But with that, thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for indulging in our little Christmas in July. And, you know, we hope you guys have a very happy and safe, with no mace and no silver and no plane turbines, holiday season.
Yeah, remember to join us next week for New Year's in July.
Ooh.
Where we'll be popping bottles all night. Just kidding. I don't think we get a New Year's episode. I don't even remember what the next episode is, but we'll find out when we get there.
That'd be fun, though. Episode of the First Res Podcast where we each drink an entire bottle of Prosecco. I'm down for that.
I'm going to be real with you. I think I could handle it like a champ.
So keep an eye out.
What else could I say? I feel like there's a good closing joke in here. Yes. So there's a song by Elvis Presley called Blue Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
They should have had the airport family's storyline intersect with the Blue Ladies storyline so that they could have had an opportunity for the most epic needle drop of all time by playing Blue Hawaii by Elvis Presley. That was the last thing I wanted to say. Now we can end the episode.